Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Maher, and I'll be your host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 under the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 nations around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in D.C., and over $400,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. Today's forum will be on U.S.-Azerbaijani relations. Our guest will be His Excellency Aline Suleimano. But first, please join me in welcoming Ali al-Husseini.
I have the honor to introduce His Excellency. I'm going to give you a brief bio about the ambassador. In October 2011, the President of the Republic of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev, appointed Aline Suleimanov as Azerbaijan's ambassador to the United States of America. Prior to that, for over 5 years, Mr. Suleimanov has been the nation's first consul general to Los Angeles and the Western states, leading the team which established Azerbaijani diplomatic presence on the West Coast. Earlier, he served as senior consular at the Foreign Relations Department, Office of the President, in Baku, Azerbaijan, and as press officer of the Azerbaijani Embassy in Washington, D.C. Mr. Suleimanov's experience before joining diplomatic service includes working with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Azerbaijan, as well as with the Open Media Research Institute in Prague, Czech Republic, and Laverbell Czech, a leading manufacturing company in East Central Europe. A graduate of the Fletcher School of Diplomacy and Law in Medford, Massachusetts, Mr. Suleimanov also holds graduate degrees from the Political Geography Department of the Moscow State University and from the University of Toledo, Ohio. Mr. Suleimanov has authored numerous articles and is a frequent presenter at academic events. He speaks Azerbaijani, English, Russian, and Czech languages. Please welcome His Excellency Ambassador Aline Suleimanov.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Ali. Thank you very much for a kind introduction. It's good to be back at Hinckley. I want to thank the Hinckley Institute for hosting this event. Actually, this is not my first time at Hinckley. It's always good to be back here, and it's always good to be back to Utah. Now, it's cold in Washington, D.C., and it's snowing in Washington, D.C., but it's also cold and snowing here, but there's a saying that the best snow in the world is in Utah. I tell you, comparing the snow in Washington and here, I can testify to that. That is really true. It's the best snow in the world. It's good to be here once again. I thank you for the University of Utah. It's good to see my good friend, Professor Yavuz here. Thank you very much. I will try to speak very briefly so we have an opportunity, I understand, for questions and answers so we don't focus only on my monologue. And you know ambassadors like to have monologues, so I will try to contain and discipline myself, but please help me with that. First and foremost, I wanted to focus on the fact that in about 22 years ago, the Republic of Azerbaijan and the United States of America have established diplomatic relationship. And what we have established has become a strategic partnership, which I believe is of crucial importance to regional stability in the South Caucasus and Eurasia as a whole. Now, look at the region of Eurasia. Everything is changing quite rapidly. You could see what happens in Ukraine. You could see what happens in Georgia, in other places. You south from Azerbaijan, a little bit to the south, you have situation in Syria. There's, of course, to the deep east of Azerbaijan, there's an issue of Afghanistan. So everything is coming up, boiling up, and in that region, one very stable country and a good friend of the United States is the Republic of Azerbaijan. So let me tell you let me try to explain myself. How does this happen and why it happens? But first, let me give you a little bit of a background, which I think would be interesting. If you look at the geography of the situation, and we had a presentation, but I thought that this is such a good-looking background, we didn't want to spoil it with a PowerPoint. But in reality, if you look at the map, and since I'm a graduate of a geography department, the map is always in front of my eyes. I wake up with a map in the morning. But if you look at the map, Azerbaijan is the only country which borders both Russia and Iran. There is no other country in the world which borders Russia and Iran. There is no other way to go from Asia to Europe without passing to the territory of Iran or Russia, other than to the Republic of Azerbaijan. Not that you necessarily want that, but that's just the reality. Now, the relationship we had with both Iranians and the Russians has been very deep, very enriching. Culturally, we have been blessed to have neighbors like this because there's an enormous cultural space both in Iran and in Russia. And we've been deeply influenced by cultures of both nations. We've also been part of the imperial structures of both the Iranian Empire and then later on, of course, the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union. We have tried to build a very good relationship with both of them. We have very good relations with the Russian Federation. We are trying to be good neighbors with the Iranians. But let me tell you this. The Republic of Azerbaijan is 9.3 million people, 9.5 million people as of the last census last several days ago. And if you look at the size of the Republic of Azerbaijan, it's roughly that of a state of Maine. Now imagine for a second. The United States of America, and you have great neighbors, both the United States of Mexico and Canadians are great people. Good people, good relationship, excellent. You have NAFTA, everything is fine. But now imagine for a second, the United States of America is the size of a state of Maine. And both Mexico and Canada remain the same size. And you still have a very friendly relationship, everything is okay. But if you are the president of the republic, which is of a state of Maine, and next to you is Mexico and Canada, you know they're your friends, you're happy that they're your friends, and you're also a little bit nervous, simply because of the size. So now look at the Republic of Azerbaijan. We are in a situation which is basically bordering the largest country in the world, that is the Russian Federation, and then, of course, to the south of us is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, in Azerbaijan, also, what you have is a combination of the Turkic world coming together with the Persian world, with the Slavic world, all of them come together. Iranian Empire, Ottoman Empire, Russian Empire come together in one place, and that's the Caucasus, and that's the Republic of Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan also has a certain internal identity division because you have a majority of Shia population, but you also have Sunni population. We have a strong Jewish community. We have also Christian. That's where the Christian world and Muslim world come together. So all kinds of Europe and Middle East. I tell you something, the border of Azerbaijan and Iran is clearly a border between Southeast Europe and Middle East. That's very obvious. If you look at it, if you go there, you could see the difference. Which all brings us to the point that, which is perhaps naturally, in 1918, on May 28th, the Republic of Azerbaijan became the first ever, democratic republic with a predominantly Muslim population in the world. Now, I don't want to repeat that. In 1918, the Republic of Azerbaijan became the first republic among the Muslim nations. Many people don't know that because it only lasted for 23 months. The Bolshevik invasion of 1920 basically ended it. But that was a statement of aspiration of my people. Now, most people know that the most successful example of a republic in the Muslim world with predominantly Muslim population has been that of the Republic of Turkey. And I think the Republic of Turkey has made a great achievement as a republic. Turkish Republic has been a great success and a beacon for many people. And I am very proud of their success, their brothers and sisters. But I'm also very proud to say that Azerbaijan was 5 years before. No, not long enough, I agree. The Turks have a much longer history than we do, but it's nice to be first, even if not for too long. I have to mention that at that time, not only the Muslim countries, but most of the countries of the region were monarchies. I mean, some of the countries in Europe are still monarchies, if you look formally at the structure. So at that time, it was very obvious. So it was a very strong move forward. And what did the Republic of Azerbaijan do among its first thing? Azerbaijan granted voting rights to all its citizens, regardless of the identity, that is going to religion, race, ethnicity, and most importantly, gender. Now, gender means that Azerbaijan was ahead of the United States of America. Though our good friends in the neighboring state of Wyoming would point out that Wyoming was ahead of the rest of the United States in women's rights. Now, imagine that. When I said that in Washington, D.C., people get puzzled. I said, yes, Azerbaijan and Wyoming are ahead of the rest of the United States of America. I feel affinity to Wyoming. I don't know how many people in Wyoming feel affinity to Azerbaijan, but they should. They should. This is something which unites us. Azerbaijan also, in 1910, the capital city of Baku, produced about 50% of global oil supply. Can you imagine? 50% of global oil was coming from Baku in 1910. Now, that's 50% is probably less than any of you used your SUV coming here. But in relative terms, it matters. All of those things introduced the general aspiration of Azerbaijan and basically positioned Azerbaijan in a situation which continues to this day, that Azerbaijan sees itself as a part of a global world, as a part of a global agenda. We want to bring people together. We want to make sure that all of us succeed. We see ourselves as a part of a region, not as a separate entity. For instance, that is why Azerbaijan, this just last December, completed its two-year term as a member of the United Nations Security Council. Imagine that. A country like Azerbaijan, newly emerging country, becomes a member of the United Nations Security Council. It's a major feat. Almost nobody in the former Soviet Union did that. How was that possible? Why was the largest number of nations voting for Azerbaijan, despite some very strong opposition, actually made Azerbaijan a member of the United Nations Security Council? And what did two things Azerbaijan do during its presidency? During the 2 years you become... Once or twice you become a president of the United Nations Security Council. You know what Azerbaijan did? First time we were the president of the United Nations Security Council, Azerbaijan focused on terrorism and efforts to combat terrorism. Second time, Azerbaijan initiated high-level dialogue between the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and United Nations Security Council. Because what many of you don't know is that the second largest international organization in the world is that of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is up until recently was called OIC, Organization. It's still called OIC, but it was called the Organization of Islamic Conference. Now think about this. That's a very strange thing. The OIC is the second largest, after UN, group, international organization in the world. Here you have the United Nations Security Council, and they never really had a formalized institutionalized dialogue. It took the Republic of Azerbaijan, not the largest country in the Muslim world, not the most prominent country in the Muslim world, to bring together both and say, look, why don't many things we discuss are actually so much related to each other. In fact, most of the time, United Nations Security Council discusses anything it has to do with the Muslim nation. So why don't you just talk to each other instead of talking past each other? And that's what Azerbaijan does. We bring folks together, try to build a region. Now, on a more specific terms for the United States, Azerbaijan today is a major transit point for cargo going, non-lethal cargo going to Afghanistan and retrograde transit coming out of Afghanistan. So it's a vital point on NDN, Northern Distribution Network. And that's why we keep getting accolades from our good friends at the Air Force and Transportation Command, and very good friends with our outgoing General Fraser, who is a commander of that. Azerbaijani troops stand in Afghanistan today, shoulder to shoulder with Americans. But more importantly, the Republic of Azerbaijan is one of the very few countries which has committed itself to post-2014 Afghanistan. You know why? Because what happens in Afghanistan matters. We haven't learned that lesson. Listen to Charlie Wilson. Look at the movie. That's a very good movie. The scary part of the movie, that he was right when he said, do not abandon Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not a place where people come and bomb and leave. This is a place which is a country which is, has people which will have to develop and become a part of the region. And we want to contribute. We can't solve Afghanistan's problem. Azerbaijan is not big enough. But we need to focus on the future of that place. Azerbaijan soldiers served in Iraq. Azerbaijani soldiers served with NATO in the Balkans. And we continue working very closely. Azerbaijan is one of the most prominent members of the anti-terrorism coalition efforts putting together. So those are all important parts. One other part which is very important, and I want to touch a little bit on this. If you look at the 22 years of American and the Western general, but American-led involvement in the former Soviet Union, if you ask me today, or if you ask yourself, which is probably even better, what is the most tangible, successful project produced by the United States of America in the region? What was the most tangible result of U.S. policy? Some people say disarmament. Several years ago, people were insisting that there were the color revolutions in different countries, which now I don't think they're going to insist, or they don't watch CNN. I would submit to you that the most successful project in the whole region is the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan oil pipeline. I'll tell you why. Not because it's an oil pipeline, but partly because of oil pipeline. That's a pipe, for the first time, a pipeline brings non-OPEC, high-quality oil from the Caspian Sea, Baku, to Georgia, to a Mediterranean port of Ceyhan in Turkey. Now, mind you, the discussion began in 1996. Ceyhan is an open seaport in a NATO-allied country of nation of Turkey. Can you imagine that? A post-Soviet nation builds an oil pipeline which terminates in a NATO country in the open sea. Today, it's a major contribution to global energy security, has provided development in Georgia, become a major, actually, input to development in Georgia, also in eastern Turkey, and provides about 40% of Israel's oil supply. So if you look at it, this is an interesting development. It also did something else. In 1996, neither Romania nor Poland, nobody else was a member of NATO. The only member of NATO around was Turkey. So it was a first physical connection, physical connection to a NATO infrastructure. What it also did, it created absolutely new geography. Think about this. For the first time, we became a player in the Mediterranean region. Turkey and the West became players in the Caspian region. We became players in the Mediterranean region. We united the three seas, Caspian, Black, and the Mediterranean. And today, just on December 17th, there was a big signature in Azerbaijan signing the oil or the gas pipeline, decision to finance the gas pipeline. The mega project cost over $45 billion, $45 billion with B. And that's a southern corridor, which consists of three pipelines. South Caucasus pipeline, the upgrade, which is Azerbaijan-Georgia. And by the way, $2 billion or $3 billion going into Georgia will be the single largest investment in Georgia. Then a major part of it is a TANAP, Trans-Anatolian pipeline, which crosses to Turkey. It's a dedicated pipeline. And from there, a third pipeline, TAP, which is Trans-Adriatic pipeline. That is Greece, Albania, Italy. Think about this. When Europeans talk about energy security, and in this case, that means energy diversity, they talk about this, they express concern every winter, then by spring they forget about it because it's not that cold. And nobody does anything. It took Azerbaijan and Turkey to move forward, to build the pipeline, to begin talking about the pipeline, move forward and build the pipeline, and then bring everybody else to make it more secure, more diversified, and more beneficial market in Europe. Now, imagine that. The partners in that project decided to invest into Albania and Greece at a time when nobody else wants to do that. Not just give them a grant, invest in their infrastructure because we believe in the future of those nations, which it also did. It once again created absolutely new geography. If you look at this, this is entire southern Europe. Now what we initiate is not just a Mediterranean connection. We make a new thing, which is Caspian, Black, Mediterranean, Aegean and Adriatic Seas. Can you imagine bringing them all together? This is a new region. This is not what we used to say, former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, all those ghetto names which you give to people and then forget about them. It's easy. What we do, we change the geography of the region. Now, I'll go back for a second and say, why was the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline doable? Which brings the key factor of the U.S. policy. In order to succeed, now think about this, the conversation about the pipeline began in 1996. The pipeline was built by 2006, 10 years. 10 years is bigger than any and longer than any two consecutive administrations, which meant that it could not be a Clinton project or a Bush project. And by the way, I have to praise the Clinton administration for fantastic work they've done on promoting that. This was a really very dedicated and very focused effort. But it was not just Clinton project, nor was it just Bush project, though I have to praise also the George W. Bush administration for picking it up and moving forward full speed. What it was an American project. And that's the key to understand. No effort, which is one administration project, is going to succeed. Because the world does not live by 4 or 8 years. The schedule of the rest of the world is different. People need to know that this is an American strategic commitment. If we see an American strategic commitment, people will follow, will support, and America will succeed. If they see this is just a temporary political thing, nobody's going to go full speed. There will be no confidence. That's why America succeeded. That's why we appreciate what Americans have done with the project, because we saw that not like, again, Clinton or Bush project, we saw it as America's dedicated project. And thank you to both Clinton and Bush administration for making sure that they succeed, being consistent. And the consistency is what matters. Which brings us to the second part of what we want to talk about today. Every time any Azerbaijani speaks in February, it's a difficult time. 22 years ago, just 2 days before the United States and Azerbaijan established a diplomatic relationship, what happened was the worst massacre in the world between Azerbaijan and Armenia. And that was a tragedy of the small town of Khojaly in Karabakh. Karabakh, Nagorno-Karabakh, is a region of Azerbaijan which was at the core of a war between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Now, Nagorno-Karabakh along with about 20% of Azerbaijan's internationally recognized territory is occupied by Armenian forces. Now, when I say internationally recognized territory, it's not a territory I dream about. It's not what I want to see. It's not what my grandmother told me was Azerbaijan. It is internationally recognized territory by the United States, by the United Nations Security Council, by everybody. This is the territory which is the Republic of Azerbaijan, universally known as this. That is that territory. That is how the map of Azerbaijan appears everywhere, because that's how the international community sees it. As you could see, there are many places we want to claim, we want to see, but those are different things. This is 20%, one-fifth of my territory is under occupation. Not only it's under occupation, it's been effectively flushed of every single human being who is not Armenian. Not only do Azerbaijani people don't live there, the Azerbaijani dogs don't, even dogs were killed. This is the most efficient ethnic cleansing I've ever seen in my life. Now, what happened in Khojaly on February 26th of 1992 was an effort to promote, to scare the people of Azerbaijan so they would leave their lands. So now look what happens. And now that's a tragedy of the situation. Even before Azerbaijan and Armenia became independent in 1995, the conflict emerged between the two nations, between the two peoples at that time. And the core of the conflict is quite simple. I referred earlier to our affinity with the state of Wyoming. Here's the underlying thinking in the Republic of Azerbaijan. If you live in the Republic of Azerbaijan, the general thinking is regardless of who you are, your ethnicity or anything, or your religion, you're a citizen of the Republic of Azerbaijan. And if you are an ethnic Azerbaijani, such as about 30 million of my brethren who live in Iran, or about 500,000 of Azeris who live in Georgia, plus minus, or in significant numbers who live in the Russian Federation, Dagestan, or elsewhere, we see you as our friends, brothers, and sisters, but you are citizens of those countries. So when, for instance, in Georgia, Azerbaijani schools had problems, Azerbaijani government in early 1990s, Azerbaijani government went to Georgian government and worked together with them a solution, tried to work out a solution to address the issues of Azerbaijanis in Georgia. However, the Armenian vision is quite the opposite. If you are an Armenian, you have to be Armenian. That's why the only country in the former Soviet Union which is 99.9% ethnically pure is the Armenian Republic. I don't want to live in a country which is 99.9% Azerbaijani. Trust me, I am Azerbaijani myself. I like my diversity. I don't like to be so overwhelmed by my own presence. I don't know how they do that. Maybe that's why they all leave so much. The other problem is, of course, that they see that everywhere Armenians live is naturally Armenia. So be it territory of Georgia, territory of Azerbaijan. I don't see that. This is a different way of thinking. This is 21st century. You cannot live by tribal thinking. We need to live as nations. Becoming an independent nation means taking responsibility for what you do. But look what happened. Look at Khojaly. The whole idea of movement for liberation of Nagorno-Karabakh as Armenians claim it turned out to be a banal massacre of individuals, similar to what happened in Srebrenica in Bosnia. But think about this. Why are Balkans are now turning into a normal place? Because people were able to address those problems, look into each other's eyes and say, what the hell have we been doing? We should never have done that. This is not a good way to move forward. And now there is a hope for Balkans. There is hope for Balkans because they talk to each other, they understand that they need to move together as a region. Azerbaijan and Georgia have succeeded enormously because we work together very closely. Georgia is Christian, Azerbaijan is Muslim, but we work together. Armenia is the only country of the region which is left out. Left out on its own self-isolation effort. Why? Why would you want to sacrifice your historic chance to build an independent, successful country for tribal reasons? So, as the region's history, recent history has shown to us, the single most dangerous threat to the future of our region as a whole and to the wider stability, because of course, I just earlier told you that it's also where the Russian Federation and Turkey and Iran come together, and that's today's modern nation, but if you look back, it's also imperial influences of those nations coming together. Imagine in that powder keg, God forbid if there's a resumption of hostilities. So this is the single largest threat to future stability of our region, and I believe to Eurasia as well, looming over our heads. So that's where Americans could be more consistent, help us to resolve this conflict and move forward with a solution. And they can. They can because we saw an example of BTC and other Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan, another project, that when America is consistent, when it's true to its principles, it can succeed. We have three co-chairs who mediate, three co-mediators of the conflict. It's the United States, Russia, and France. And I have to commend the United States. They have been more active recently. But we need to do more. And we need to bring the solution because this is in the best interest of all of us. Anyway, I've seen the ominous sign from the back saying that it's time for me to move on to questions and answers, and I will happily do so. And thank you for your attention, and I hope I didn't talk for too long. Thank you. You'll be the question now, yes.
Now, if you have any questions, please raise your hand, and please speak into the mic. Yeah, please say your first and last name.
Hi, I'm Aline Brown, and I just had some questions about the pipeline that you were discussing. Is it above ground or in ground? How big is it, and what volume is it? And does it currently operate at its full volume, or was it designed to increase the capacity that it can carry?
Thank you. It is underground. It's more or less underground. I think it's about 1-2 meters underground throughout its whole. I think most of its corridor, I think it's underground. I think it's, what was it? It's about 1 billion barrels a day or something like that. No, that's, the, no, this is the gas pipeline. We're talking about the oil pipeline. No, I think it's 100,000 barrels a day. which brings it to and it was designed. It can go up. You could jack it up, but it depends on oil deliveries. Actually, it goes based on production. It sometimes operates on its full capacity, sometimes not the full capacity. But so far, it's been very profitable. Of course, because oil prices dynamic also goes up and down.
Yeah, hi, my name is Kevin Huang. I was just curious. I didn't really catch what you said earlier. You said that the day after that, the Armenian massacre, that we joined, or you guys joined forces with the U.S., was that like for politics or for military help or for what?
Thank you. No, it's. I think both of unrelated issues, because at that time the United States was establishing diplomatic relationship with the countries of the former Soviet Union. And it also coincided, the two events. But it's a glaring example of a coincidence, which is very telling, I think. So on one hand, you're trying to build an independent nation. At the same time, you're getting a most significant and difficult moment in your chapter of history.
I'm Ali Al-Husseini. I would like to know what's the stance of the Azeri government on the Karabakh region, and how about the Iranian-Azeri relations? We haven't spoken about that.
Thank you. And here I was trying to be a little bit more discreet. But on Karabakh, the situation is very simple. This is the territory of Azerbaijan. It's internationally recognized. We want to have a solution as soon as possible. For 22 years, we had negotiations which have not produced a single inch of progress, which is very sad in many ways, because if you think about this, Russia, France, and the United States, the most significant countries in the world, try to solve it, and nothing happens. I used to serve as a UNHCR officer, High Commissioner for Refugees, and I saw this people suffering firsthand. This is really a very unpleasant situation. Generations grew up in a refugee camp. Now, no longer, of course, because Azerbaijan, by the way, is one of the very few countries which used its energy, oil money, right away to move our refugees and displaced people from the camps. So now we build the public housing for them, there are new villages for these people. So Azerbaijan is not trying to showcase its suffering. What we're trying to do is to build a region. I think that's the most important thing. Now, we don't want a military solution. We want to, that's why, and if you ask me, prove it, for 22 years, despite a clear statement of the United Nations Charter, Article 51, which allows us, which gives us full right to use force, Azerbaijan has not used force. Why? Because we understand that this is not a good thing. But this cannot go forever. You cannot expect Azerbaijan to give up one-fifth of its territory, to have to acquiesce to a displacement of 1 million people out of 1 million, I mean, that's pretty big, and never act on the fact that there's a military force occupying, committing ethnic cleansing right on my territory. This is not normal. So what we tell Armenians is, let us solve this issue. So that's our stand on Karabakh, and I think it's widely shared by the international community. I mean, there's a United Nations Security Council resolutions calling for withdrawal of Armenian troops and solving the issue. Now, that's one side. The other side of your question is, of course, Azerbaijan-Iranian relationship. And it's a sophisticated, complicated relationship because, of course, we share a lot with Iran, culture. We share ethnicity with much of Iran. About 30 million people in Iran are ethnic Azeris, as we talked about. But we have different views on how to build our nation. Iranians believe that the best way to have a country is the Islamic Republic, run by ideology of Islamic State. We believe in a secular state in which there is a clear separation between church and state. Iranians have the right to build their country the way they want, but we also have a right to build our country without interference. And I think that is the most important underlying assumption in our relationship. So as long as we both respect our choices, and of course Iran is a much bigger country than Azerbaijan, so it's more difficult for them to respect a smaller country, then we're doing fine.
Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Please join me in thanking our guests for another wonderful forum.
Thank you. Thank you, man. And by the way, we have some brochures in the back, so you could pick.